don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
In around 11 weeks' time, American voters will be choosing their next president in one of the most important elections in the history of the country. And today's guest on Second Captain Saturday will be front and centre of the television coverage beamed around the world. Welcome to the show. Hey, Murph.
Hey, Owen.
John King cut his teeth as a print journalist with the Associated Press before moving into TV with CNN, where he has served as senior White House correspondent, anchor of the Inside Politics show, and he's currently chief national correspondent. But as soon as you heard the name John King, I'm pretty sure your first thought may well have been the magic wall. King has become a bit of a cult hero for his mastery of this piece of touchscreen technology that allows him to make sense of the numbers on election night. It also helps the rest of us feel like we understand precisely how important, I don't know, Maricopa County is going to be to the Democrats' chances of holding on to Arizona, Murph.
Well, everyone knows about Maricopa County, Owen. Come on, for God's sake. But the magic wall...
We don't need John King's help with that.
Yeah, it is an amazing piece of equipment, to be fair. With one swipe of John's finger, we're given the votes counted in that district, anywhere across America, at that moment on election night, how that district voted in like the last five elections, socioeconomic breakdowns. If you thought the lads on the Sunday game circling the number of defenders behind the ball on an iPad looked high tech on, well, get a load of this thing.
Yeah. The love for him here has increased exponentially since the 2020 election, thanks to the Derry Girls writer Lisa McGee tweeting, "Is John King Irish yet?" This was during those fraught days in 2020, to which King himself took the time out to respond, "Always," before revealing that his grandparents hailed from Connemara. John is spending this election year travelling around the battleground states, so there literally isn't anyone in America better placed to measure what seems to be the spectacular impact that Kamala Harris has made since she entered the presidential race. There was a poll during the week that you may have seen that had Harris leading or tied in 6 of the 7 swing states polled. That's compared to the same survey in May that showed Trump leading Joe Biden or tied across all those 7 swing states. So we're going to chat to John about that. Also, we're going to talk to him about how he's dealt with multiple sclerosis, something he was diagnosed with over 15 years ago now, but he only revealed publicly for the first time in 2021. And I don't know, something tells me that coming from the most sports mad city in the US is going to stand him in pretty good stead for our greatest non-sports person competition.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, on Brendan Gleeson set a modest enough target of 83 points on show one in this series, but we're past the halfway point and he still leads. John King is a busy man and he may not quite realise it yet, but over the course of the next hour, I will assess his sporting ability, choose a real life sports person that I think best matches up with his talents, and then consider his all-time sporting highlight toward him a points total out of 100. Politicians of all stripes have had occasion to say, "The people have spoken, the bastards." John has delivered the news of ultimate victory and defeat to generations of elected officials, but today, I am the people, and my voice will be heard.
Email us at... I think John, if John King is here in this party, he's probably wondering why he came onto the show. Email us at editor@secondcaptains.com. Tweet at Second Captains. The unmistakable voice of CNN's John King is coming your way on Second Captain Saturday. Pedestrian at Best by Courtney Barnett on Second Captain Saturday. Our guest today is always one of the most familiar faces in Ireland on US election night. And that was especially true in the long, drawn-out election of 2020, when he somehow managed to turn us all into experts in the voting patterns of every obscure electoral district in America. But as a self-proclaimed sports freak, does he have what it takes to be our greatest non-sportsperson of 2024? Joining us from Washington, D.C., John King. Welcome to Second Captain Saturday.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
Well, it's a privilege for us because, I mean, I presume you're pretty busy at the moment, to say the least.
A little bit. We have this election thing coming up. It's so 80 or so days away, but it's all good. I like being busy. I'd rather be busy than bored.
Fair enough. Yeah, you were certainly busy in 2020, as I mentioned. Was it surreal to find yourself becoming a cult hero back here in Ireland in those days?
it was surreal and a big surprise when it initially hit me, seeing on Twitter, Irish Twitter embracing me, and it became one of the most heartwarming experiences and gratifying experiences of my life. And it kicked me in the head. Every now and then I need a good kick in the head, to do something I'd wanted to do for years and just hadn't taken the initiative. You always make an excuse. You're too busy. I've got work. I've got to deal with my kids. I have a health challenge. I'm busy at work again. To actually come and see where I'm from. And I did after the campaign. And being up in Connemara and seeing the essentially the small hut house where my grandfather came from, visiting the school and seeing his handwritten school records from back in the day, it just opened my eyes. And it at moments I felt my blood draining, and at other times I felt my body just filling with adrenaline. And then to be greeted, let's be honest, in Keogh's pub up there near the house, and then in Tom King's pub down in Clifton, I got the full experience. And now I understand I'm not a blow-in. Yeah. I'm a local, so I can come back. I can come back and move in because I'm not a blow-in like so many other people there. So I'm happy. Talking I will come about, back and plant my flag.
Yeah. So this is Dún Láthán, which so if my geography is correct, you get to Ballykeneely, and then you start going west. So, I mean, I think if people know Ballykeneely, I think they might be laboring under the misapprehension that there isn't anything further west than Ballykeneely. But that's where you're from, Dún Láthán.
Yes, it's not a short swim to America, but it's the shortest swim to America.
You grew up then in Dorchester, Boston. Were you a happy kid?
I was a happy kid. My childhood was loud. There were seven children. My mother had seven children in 9.5 years. And we used to joke with her when we got older and we could have these conversations. My older sister and I would call my mother the sex machine, and she would say, no, I only had sex 7 times.
It's a 100% success rate, though. So that's good.
But my dad was a bull of a strong guy physically. My mother was very quiet. And when you're a kid, you don't appreciate it, especially as a boy. You think your dad is so strong. Your dad is so strong. And both my parents died too young. But I realized after my dad died, I was in my mid-20s then, how strong my mother was. And you learned, I always say now that I learned the strength, that dignity is quiet. And that was my mother. She didn't have to say much. She would just give you that look. her eyes and her facial expression could say more than all the words of the dictionary. If mom was mad at you, she had a way to let you know without saying anything. But I had a very happy childhood. It was loud. 5 boys and 2 girls. We were always fighting, but in the best of ways, right? We're always competing. Every now and then, a little blood from a bloody nose from the boys wrestling in the backyard or wrestling in the living room. But cherished, just cherished. And my dad and my mom, we didn't have much money. We had almost no money. They just instilled in us early on, just work hard. Be yourself. Work hard. Be a good person. Be an honest person. Be a decent person. And remember the people around you.
That work ethic was something I know you put into action very early on, delivering newspapers around your neighborhood as a kid, John. And print journalism was actually where you started out as a reporter as well, before you became a TV superstar.
I did, and I'm grateful I did. I don't know that I'm a TV superstar, but thank you. I have a job that happens to be on television. But I'm very lucky. I was at college, and I think like a lot of kids at university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had a Shakespeare professor who said, you like to write, you should try this journalism thing. So I took a journalism class, and I had a great instructor there who said, I can teach you the basics, but there's only one way to find out if you actually like this, and that's to get it, go do it. And he helped me get an internship at the Wire Service, the Associated Press, and they let me do things when I was done with the stuff I had to do. And all of a sudden, I realized, I was going to court hearings. I was going to legislative hearings. Providence, Rhode Island is where that was at the time. And there's a great, I say great, it's illegal, but a very interesting organized crime ring that was based in Providence, Rhode Island. So there were great, exciting stories. Yeah, I say these things sometimes. People, he likes the mob. No, I just mean
it's an important clarification, John. Yeah.
I think you've cleared this one up beautifully. Yeah.
Good Italian, very good Italian food. Always open late because they had to have an establishment open so they could run money through and things. But I just all of a sudden realized they pay people to do this. I was listening, to your program about coming back from the Olympics. I mean, it's a blessing that we get to do this, right? They let us go meet interesting people, talk to interesting people, see interesting things. And I was just like, it's like, I'm in, right? We pay to go to school or we pay to go to university. I had to borrow a lot of money to get through. And now I think, don't tell my bosses, but I would do this for free, right? You get to travel the country and travel the world, meet really interesting people. And it's a gift. It's wonderful.
Your parents must have been very proud. I know you said earlier on that they died way too young, so they haven't got to see all the success that you've had, but they at least got to see some in those early days.
Yeah, my dad didn't really get to see much of it.
Right.
Because one of the interesting things, my first big break was I got to cover the 1988 presidential campaign. And my dad died just before Thanksgiving in 1987. And I remember telling my mother, I can't do this. I have to stay home. I have to stay home and be around the family. And she just, again, didn't say much. She just looked at me and she said, what would your father want you to do? I'm going to tear up telling the story. Sorry. But it was, so I did. I went out and I did it. And then my mother died right after the 1992 election. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas. Bill Clinton was the governor then and was the president-elect when my mother died. But one of my cherished gifts is a note from my mother when I was covering the first Persian Gulf War, when George H.W. Bush was president and Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and, you know, the world came together to kick him out. I did a TV interview. I did a story. I was the only reporter that snuck into this little town called Kafji, that the Iraqis had actually crossed into Saudi Arabia. And the American military denied they were there. The Saudis denied they were there. But because I and another Associated Press colleague went up there, we documented the story. They had to admit that all that was true. And so an American television network interviewed me and put me on television. And I got essentially a three-paragraph note from my mother, who, my handwriting is horrible. My mother had the most beautiful handwriting I could ever imagine. And it just, you know, it just said, your father would be very proud of you. Stay safe. Please come home now. Oh. I keep it folded up because it's just one of the most cherished things I have.
That's beautiful. How did you end up on CNN then? How did you end up having a television career?
I was the chief political correspondent for the Associated Press, and I had great bosses and great mentors who became my friends. And so CNN approached me after the 1996 campaign, and I initially said no because I loved where I worked. And I had great bosses and I had great friends, and I owe them everything professionally. And so it was really hard. And so CNN said, look, you've been covering Bill Clinton. We want you to cover the White House. And I was like, I don't want to cover the White House because it's confining. The gates around the White House, think of it literally. We can talk more about this if you want. It became one of the greatest gifts of my life because I got to see things and travel the world. But I viewed it as confining because I liked wandering America as a political reporter. I got to see the world as a White House correspondent, and I learned so much because of it. But they finally talked me into it. That I was like, I'm a print guy. I don't want to put on a tie. I wear makeup now. I mean, you know, all these things were like, because I loved my job so much. Some people change jobs when they're unhappy. I was incredibly happy in my work, and I loved my work. And so it was a very hard decision for me to make. And one of the things CNN said was, well, come on in. And if you're miserable, you know, you're going to sign a contract. But if you're miserable, we'll just rip up the contract and let you go. So I came in and I did it. And I was really bad at it for a long time. If you go back and look at the early tapes.
Were you, really though? Is that something that you just say in a self-effacing way now? Or do you honestly think if you look back at those early tapes, you actually weren't great at the time?
I was terrible. It's like the old American movie Broadcast News. If you see it, the guy wears a blue shirt and he's sweating through it all the time. That was me. I was so nervous. But it's actually an amazing thing. The first time you go out to do a live shot on television, I started directly at the White House. That was my first job, White House correspondent, and that was at the time. You know, Bill Clinton was let's just say an interesting character. There were a lot of things happening in the world. But when you stand on that, you walk out and there's your camera and there's a little perch where you stand. And then you just look over your shoulder and there's the White House. I mean, like right over your shoulder is the White House. So it's like being in a chapel or in a church or some museum. And it's, you just realize, whoa, that's the White House. And we had a little tiny office. I was blessed that the senior correspondent in those days was Wolf Blitzer. And he, you know, he embraced the new kid and helped me make the transition to television. But I'm still here, so I must be doing all right.
Still here, you're doing all right, John. When did you first meet the magic wall, and was it love at first sight?
So the magic wall was introduced in 2008 by a brilliant former bureau chief here who passed away last year, sadly. David Borman was his name. And David was an innovator, and he would always look for new ways to tell stories. And he went to a military convention, military hardware convention, where they sell tanks and, you know, rocket-propelled grenade guns. But he saw this monitor that these guys at NYU had come up with, these software guys, that they were pitching to the military. And he was just so brilliant, his brain said, oh my, what I could do with that, with politics. People felt like you were taking them on the journey, that you weren't just telling them something, you were taking them there. So we go into, you know, Georgia, and then we go to Fulton County, and we stretch it out, and we explain, you know, the population here is overwhelmingly black, and then we move out. Now we're in Gwinnett County. We're going out to the suburbs. It's getting a little bit more affluent. It's more white out here. What's under the ground, right? This is a, you know, West Virginia. These are coal mines. You come here, these are car factories. You go here, it's more medical and scientific, and so that affects who lives there. That affects how much money they make. It affects where they get their energy, and that affects how they vote. And so when you get to take people along on the journey, they just felt that it was easier to explain. It was easier to see. They were seeing places they knew and going places they didn't know. But I do think my personal experience that I had before the Magic Wall did help, you know, did help me. I had the sort of the software in my brain of my own travels and my own curiosity. And then one of the things I do between elections is, in addition, this year I'm blessed in the job I have this cycle. I'm traveling. I just got back from, you know, one trip. I just got back from Iowa last week. I was in Pennsylvania. A couple mm-hmm. weeks before that, I was in Wisconsin. You know, we're just moving around to the key places all the time to sort of update the software, if you will, because there's always changes between every election. But I also read a lot of data.
Well, tell us, John, what have you been hearing then in those battleground states on the ground? We've all seen the polls, obviously, and we're following the news from America in the last few weeks. What sense are you getting about the impact that Kamala Harris has been having since she's joined the race?
It's enormous. It has completely changed the dynamic of the campaign. After President Biden's debate performance, he was on a path to lose. And he was on a path to lose. Most of our recent elections have been pretty close. He was on a path to lose in a blowout. And he was on a path to lose in a way that would not only cost the Democrats the White House, but the Democrats who were saying, Mr. President, we're worried, you know, we'll also lose control of the Senate. We will not be able to retake the House of Representatives. We will have a landslide. It would be a Republican landslide. Would that have happened? Of course, we'll never know that. But was the data there to support that? Both statistically, the data, and anecdotally, when you're on the ground in those places, it was like all the air had been taken out of the Democratic balloon. And the Democrats saw their president as invisible. Now they see, you know, a woman of color getting on and off the plane, showing up in these states, prosecuting a case with energy against Donald Trump, picking a running mate who they think is an interesting, different person. And so they have created an enormous opportunity. They've made this a competitive race. And you could argue, looking at the data, that she might even have a narrow lead in that race right now. But let's, for safety purposes, call it a tie. Think of how different that is from just a few weeks ago. And so now she has this enormous opportunity to win. She has a chance to win where I would argue President Biden did not. You know, could he have changed that again? Maybe, but he was in a very, very bleak place. She has a chance to win. That would be historic. Now she has almost 3 months left in the campaign, a little less than that, 2.5 months left in the campaign, where a lot of tests. You know, she's riding a high right now. She's performing, I think, above a lot of expectations that even a lot of Democrats had. Could she communicate this well? Could she be disciplined? Could she be consistent? Could she bring in more people to help with the campaign? They're checking the boxes very well so far. I just add the emphasis on so far. Now the question is, can she continue to perform at that high level? She's in the playoffs now. and can you continue to perform at that high level? If you make a mistake, let's just say when you make a mistake. You know, everybody makes mistakes. When a mistake happens or when something goes the other way, you know, how quickly do you get up and how do you perform once you do? So we will see that as we go forward. But it's been a fascinating shift, and you just feel it. You see it in all the polling data. But we were in Arizona, guys knocking on doors, you know, progressive organization knocking on doors, trying to register voters and get people engaged in a rural area that's largely Republican. It was 105 degrees. I don't know how that translates into Celsius, but
warm.
Hot. Yeah, hot. You know, they say in the desert it's a dry heat. It's still triple digit heat. And these guys had a bounce in their step. You know, they're knocking on doors, they're sweating through their shirts, but they were just so happy because they have a candidate who has energy. And so because she has energy, they have energy. And it has just fundamentally changed the race.
You say that she's campaigning on good vibes, and that's absolutely correct. She still hasn't sat for like a lengthy interview or faced a debate with Donald Trump. So the question still kind of remains that the enthusiasm we see now is not something that's going to last all the way to November. Those challenges, the possible mistakes that you reference, that might be, you know, those are the moments where the mistake might happen.
Absolutely right. And look, they've agreed to at least one debate. The question is, will there be more? she's going to have to at some point sit down. Now, you know, again, she has the momentum her way. So in our business, of course, we want the vice, we want any candidate for any office to be doing interviews quite frequently. We want them to be available to reporters, you know, just for the daily press conferences on the fly. We want them, that should be every day. Of course, it's not going to be every day, but that should be our principle, that we want to see you. We want the chance to ask you questions, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It never works that way. And you have to also understand, you know, she has momentum right now. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But at some point, you're absolutely right, because Trump is going to taunt her about this. You know, where are you? Why are you hiding from reporters? Can she get all the way to November and win an election without doing several big media interviews? Maybe. You know, some of this is, you know, I always say, you know, journalists have to beware of navel gazing. Yeah. Or thinking that we're so important that, you know, no one's going to vote for her. You know, if they don't talk to John King, or if they don't talk to ABC News or CNN, or, you know, I mean, so part of that is give me a break. Let's not make ourselves so important. But you're right that one of the big questions about her is that where is she on policy? She's the vice president of the United States. She ran a very uneven, not very good campaign for president when she was challenging, you know, Joe Biden and the others in the primaries. She was a horrible candidate, let's just be honest. But people grow. I mean, that my test is always, are they growing, right? Are they learning from their mistakes? Are they growing? She has grown enormously. But I do think first the debate, and then as she tries to fill out the policy canvas, here's where I will be, you know, just the same as Joe Biden. Here's where I might be a little different to Joe Biden. Here's how I see different challenges for different communities. Even if the policy hasn't changed, how do you communicate it? What do you emphasize for different constituencies? It's a giant challenge for her. And one logical way to do that is to do some interviews. And then, you know, they'll do the big speeches and the events. But I think it's only logical that some of that, a piece of that pie, should be sitting down for extended interviews with experienced, seasoned journalists. So they can, you know, throw the questions at you and play all the things she said in 1999 or 2000 that she might have a different view on now. Now, Donald Trump used to be a Democrat. He used to be totally pro-abortion rights. He was for an assault weapons ban. He gave money to Hillary Clinton and other Democrats who are in the running for office. I mean, everybody raise your hand. You know, all of those who've never changed their mind, raise your hand. Right? But she is going to have to answer that. She has changed her mind on a number of important policy issues, and she's going to have to explain why.
Are you surprised at the difficulty Trump seems to have been in trying to just figure out how to handle this new challenge?
Yes and no. He is who he is. And again, he won the presidency in 2016 by attacking Hillary Clinton personally, by going off on a lot of meandering wanderings and airing of grievances that people who had covered prior campaigns had never seen before. So therefore, we said, there's no way this can work. And he won. And so to tell him that doesn't work, it's a hard argument. And look, I don't read minds. Donald Trump keeps saying that he also won in 2020. He did not. Mm. He did not. He did not. He had 70 court cases to try to prove election fraud, and he lost them all, including cases with judges he had appointed, who told his attorneys, you've given me nothing. There's no evidence here. You're just making this up. He lost. He keeps continuing to say he won. But he came very close. And so I would not, anyone out there who's betting that Donald Trump is suddenly going to change his ways and become a disciplined candidate who talks only about policy has paid no attention to the last 8-9 years of American political life. Now, he also, if you go back to the 2016 experience, or if you watch when he was president and Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House, there's a pretty good track record that Donald Trump has trouble with strong women, that he has trouble dealing with women who present themselves as his equal, if not his better. It gets him to be even more combative. And, you know, he's being a lot of people, there are a lot of smart people around Donald Trump telling him, stop being so personal. Stop letting her get under your skin. Talk about policy, talk about inflation, talk about the economy. But as you see, he was supposed to give a big economic speech this past week, where one of the first things he said was, I'm here to talk about the economy. Although I'm not so sure that's an important issue. So he is his own worst enemy sometimes. But he, you know, that's what makes him such a fascinating subject to study in American politics. Because I've been doing this for almost 40 years. So I always say, like, I have all this experience. That is so important that I have all this experience. Well, guess what? Think about everything in our life. Sometimes the rules matter. Sometimes experience matters. Sometimes we're in uncharted territory. And he has rewritten the rules of American politics. You know, going back to 2016, when he launched and succeeded with a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, right before our eyes. Often these things are done in secret. He did it right before your eyes. He took over a political party that didn't want him. And now he owns it. Now it's his. So the history books would tell you, you can't do it this way. But 2016 told us, well, it can just barely. He lost the popular vote, but he won. And so he's unconventional. That's a sort of a tame way of saying it, but he's unconventional, and we're just going to have to ride it out. But he does seem off his game. She has rattled him. He thought he was running against a president with no energy, who couldn't physically be out there on the campaign trail, who had a lot of doubts about his job performance, a lot of doubts about the strength of the American economy. And Trump essentially thought it was over, especially after the debate. He thought it was over. And now it is not over. It is just beginning.
It's only mid-August, John. Probably too soon for you to call it. I'm hoping for a prediction from you here.
Well, I have no predictions. That's not my job. My job is to watch. I would hope that we do not have election week in America again, that we have election night in America. But we, as you're listening in Ireland, be prepared. Be prepared to stay with me, to drink coffee with me, to maybe sneak a pint with me when you can. It may be a few days.
The voice you're hearing on Second Captain Saturday today is a very familiar one to anyone who follows CNN's election coverage. After the break, John King will make his pitch to become our Second Captain's greatest non-sports person, sports person.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
You're listening to Second Captain Saturday with Owen and Murph and CNN's Chief National Correspondent John King, who's with us this week. John's been giving us really fascinating insights into the upcoming US election and his own role covering it on CNN. Since the last election in 2020, John, you've revealed on air that you have MS, and it's something you've been dealing with for a long time. Why did you decide to go public when you did?
Well, I didn't plan it, but we were having a conversation in the back of my mind in the debates about COVID vaccines and about whether you should wear a mask and whether wearing a mask was somehow succumbing to, government mandates and government orders. I'm immunocompromised because of the medicines I take for multiple sclerosis. And I'm blessed in that, I have a disease that every day does something to me. It can exhaust me. I get headaches. Sometimes I have difficulty walking. Sometimes I have difficulty holding things. It tends to be in my extremities. But I also know that on the spectrum of people with MS, I am so lucky. I am so lucky. It is a cruel, debilitating disease to so many. And because of my experience with it, I know a lot about other issues. People have other, immunocompromising diseases and just other things. And so it's made me a much more empathetic person to understand the person who might be walking so slowly and frustrating you, and you think they're just not paying attention. Well, maybe there's something going on in their life. And one of the presenters on another network was screaming about masks and about vaccines, and the vaccines had just become available. And so one of our medical experts was talking about this issue, and it had been in the back of my brain, obviously, for some time that I wanted to say something about this. I didn't think I was going to do it on live television, but I just said how grateful I was because I'm immunocompromised and I have multiple sclerosis, and I'm grateful for the vaccines, and I'm grateful for the people who aren't afraid to put on a mask to think maybe you're protecting somebody else and helping somebody else, and that we needed to just stop the stupid political debates about all this and start operating under the old golden rule, love your neighbor, treat your neighbor like you want to be treated yourself. And so it blurted out, and here we are.
When were you, said it was something you were dealing with for a long time. When were you actually diagnosed with MS?
I was diagnosed in 2008. Another interesting things happened to me in presidential campaign years. I was at the Republican convention, and I was on the floor standing around, and I had had problems with my legs, numbness in my legs and issues in my legs for some time. And I damaged the two lower discs in my spine in a car accident many, many years ago. And I'm fine. But the doctor always thought that must be it. Maybe there's a pinched nerve in there, or you've done something that's every now and then you're just having these issues. And all of a sudden, the numbness and the inability to feel, it tends to start in the extremities. My feet have been, I haven't really felt my feet since Bill Clinton was president.
Right.
And it moves up. And it moves up my legs. Usually it's from about the thighs down. I have very limited sensation in my legs. But you learn through exercise and other things to get through it. And some days are much worse than others, and some days are pretty reasonably okay. But the sensation came up to my chest, and I was having difficulty breathing at the convention, and it moved into my hands for the first time. And I was having trouble lifting my arms, bending my shoulders and coming up with my arms. And it was exhausting. I was like, my brain was having to tell my body to do things that we all do routinely and reflexively. And we're obviously, our brain is thinking about it, but we're not thinking about it. We're not conscious that we're thinking about it. We just do them because it's part of our daily routine. And so I went to see the paramedics there at the convention. And then after that, I went through a series of tests, blood tests, MRIs, and all that. And when the MRIs came back, for anyone familiar with multiple sclerosis, they have these little lesions, and they look, to me, like little dried flowers, essentially. And they're along your central nervous system, along, you know, along your spine. And mine start up near my brain stem, and they go all the way back down my spine. And so there's a little set of lesions that, again, they look like little tiny dry flowers. And now where they are along your nervous system and whether they keep growing and spreading is essentially decides whether you have nagging, annoying MS, what I have technically called relapsing, remitting, and that there are really bad days, and then there are some days where it's not so bad at all, or progressive. And for those who have progressive MS, it is an incredibly cruel, quick, debilitating disease. I have been, knock on wood, that would be my skull, blessed that my medications seem to have slowed the growth now for 16 years. And through medicines and through my own exercise routine and learning, you know, understanding what's happening to me, I'm much more aware now when there's something happening in my body. I'm great. I really am. I have a challenge. Everybody has a challenge, whether it's a medical challenge or a physical challenge or a mental health challenge or a family challenge. Everybody has challenges. And so you at first you feel a little self-pity and all those other things. My worry was, you know, I have two older children, but I have a younger son too. It's like, am I going to be able to play with my children? Am I going to go to the game with my children? Am I going to, you know, hit ground balls to my son or throw a football to my son? 16 years later, I consider myself incredibly fortunate, number one. And I've learned so much. I'm a better, stronger person, even though I have a challenge.
You've said there are good days and bad days. I know the 2020 election was particularly grueling. That was quite challenging for you.
Yeah, by the end of that week, sometimes standing on hard surfaces exacerbates things. Heat and stress are my two biggest triggers. They keep some of my colleagues get mad at me because I tell them to pump the studios cold. It's like an ice chest. Some of my colleagues are raising their hands saying it's cold, and I'm saying too bad. Too bad. And now in the last campaign, above the magic wall, they put in a special vent for me, so it kind of blows, you know, blows cold. The North Pole, I call it, right above the magic wall, blows down on me. But as we went through that week, I couldn't feel my hands, and of course my hands are key to moving around on the magic wall. And so if you go back and look at it, I have to watch it, you'll see I was following my fingers more than normal. Normally I just trust them. I know where they're going, right? Okay. I know where Pennsylvania is, and I know where Delaware County is, and I know how to get northwest to Erie County. And you can do it out of the corner of your eye. Because I was so nervous, my eyes were staying with my fingers a little bit longer to make it get there. But I got through it. I got through it. And, you know, I'll say this. Why should I say this? But, you know, my ex-wife, who happens to be one of my best friends, works for CNN, Dana Bash, and she was the only one who noticed. And she sent me a text one thing. She says, "Are you okay?"
This is at the time as you were still broadcasting.
When I was on live television, yeah. She's across the room on the panel, and she could see it. I get a little bit more stilted in my walking, and it's hard and it's frustrating, which, you know, just made me proud to get through it.
What sort of physical activity do you do to help you in that regard?
I do a lot of walking, even when my legs feel like lead, just to stay strong physically, so that if I start having other issues, I want to have the strength in case I'm having other issues. I spend a lot of time on the treadmill. I spend a lot of time working my hands and trying to, I don't put on a blindfold, but sometimes with my eyes closed at home, picking things up and putting them down. I've never actually talked about that before, but I do some things when there's nobody watching, and then look away and try to see if I pick them up, you know, if my instincts are right about where I put it and everything, or do I need to see it. Every now and then I had this happen a couple times, and people think, you know, what's wrong with this guy? When I can't feel my hands, imagine you have a glass in your hands. If I get distracted by conversation, so you're at a social event and you're holding a glass of beer or a glass of wine or a glass of water, and you're talking to somebody, I have to tell my brain, hold that glass, hold that glass, hold that glass. And every now and then sort of move my fingers to make sure I have it. And so I have occasionally broken a glass in my hands. And they're like, wow, he's probably had too many drinks already, right? You just break the glass standing there. And you just, that's happened previous to anybody knowing about this, that has happened. And you just have to act like a goof, right? You know, I'm an idiot. I hold that too tight. I lost my attention or whatever. And you pick it up and you clean it up and you move on. But little things like that, just to say, you know, here's how I feel today, but I know the other day I felt differently, so let's prepare for that. It's like any sports team, right? You practice contingencies, you know.
Were you always sporty anyway as a kid, as well as watching it? Did you like to be active?
I've always loved being active. That does not translate into my always being very good at it. I was a probably, I would say, a fairly mediocre average athlete. But when we were kids, we played street hockey outside. We always played baseball. My dad loved baseball, and I think that just rubbed off. American football is a great passion. I played in high school, and I like to play. And I brought to the podcast just because I know you guys are sports freaks. Just so, again, I wish the audience could see it. This football we had when Barack Obama accepted the Democratic nomination in 2008, it was at Mile High Stadium where the Denver Broncos play out in Colorado.
Yeah.
And so you're sitting around on the set, and you're spending a lot of time sitting. You have to get there early to get through security. You're sitting there when there's somebody's giving a 30-minute speech, and you're still sitting on the set. So we got this football just so we could clown around and toss the ball and just stay active and have a little fun. And so I've kept it. It stays with me all the time because, that was a pretty historic night and part of a historic election year.
Amazing. So
this stays in my office, and it's become like a fidget. Those little fidget tools kids get to, when they're – this is my fidget tool. When I'm nervous at work or I'm trying to write and I can't really think something through, I pick up my fidget tool and I toss the football around a little bit and off we go.
We should mention this cycle you went on, charity cycle, which was pretty epic by all accounts.
So before I disclose my MS diagnosis publicly, a woman I went to high school with, who was a friend of mine back in Boston, she has MS, and she started a team in this. The MS Society does amazing fundraising work to try to help. There's no cure for MS at the moment, and there's all this research going into it. And so there's a 150-mile bicycle ride. For those of you familiar with Boston, you start in Boston and you go all along the coast south, and the terrain is gorgeous because you're along the ocean. Also, parts of it are pretty rugged. It gets a little rocky and goes up. And so they do it over 2 days. You do 75 miles, you camp out, you wake up first thing the next morning, and you do the rest. And so when I did it, I had my MS diagnosis was still secret, but I did. Joanne is my high school classmate's name. And I did tell her because I knew she was going through a struggle. And when I saw her, she was not sure she was going to be able to make the ride because, she has good days and bad days as well. And as part of my effort to, I guess, sort of in a demented way, cheer her up, I said, I have MS too. We're going to get through this together. And that was the beginning of my getting more comfortable, actually, talking to people about it. And to me, it's just one of those overwhelming positive experiences where you see just the sense of community, people giving to others to try to help others. And that was a great event for me. And my youngest was born actually right before days before I did that first one. And his birthday weekend, I haven't been able to get back to it. But now that he's a teenager, he doesn't want dad around so much anymore. So I'm going to try to get back on the bike and get out there next year.
John, you are not the first Bostonian we've had on. Conan O'Brien was on our last series, another Red Sox fan who actually caught a ball at Fenway once, which is pretty impressive. Have you got anything to rival that?
I have caught a ball at Fenway.
Oh, you've literally caught a ball at Fenway as well.
literally caught a ball at Fenway. Again, your instincts kick in. I was standing on the Green Monster with a group of friends, and David Ortiz, the great Red Sox designated hitter, hit a ball, was coming right for me, and I started to reach out with my hands, and I was reaching out to do a baseball catch. And then lucky for me, my hockey experience kicked in and I said, don't do that. It'll hit off your hands, it'll bounce off your hands. And so in a matter of seconds, I switched and I went hockey goalie. Yeah. I just got dead. I got
the
dead
bread,
center.
You opened up the bread basket. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so I took it off the wrist, off the chest, down to the floor. And that was it.
John, there are some strong contenders there already. But before we rank your sporting life, we are going to have to pin you down on a highlight of your career, an all-time sporting highlight. If you can choose one, please.
I was blessed one day to be asked in 2012 to throw out the first pitch at Fenway Park, ceremonial first pitch. If you're not familiar with American baseball, mm-hmm. before they start the game, they bring someone out who stands on the pitcher's mound every day and they throw it in. And sometimes it's a local politician, sometimes it's a local hero, someone who's overcome some hardship. And I was there, and it was the beginning of a series against the New York Yankees. That's evil, right, to us. I have great respect for the Yankees franchise. If you're a Red Sox fan, it's God versus Satan. And so they asked me to throw out the first pitch, and I had my two older children, my son, Noah, and my daughter, Hannah, and my baby at that time, Jonah, was just 1 year old. And they asked me to do it, and I was walking out. My older son put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, Dad, if you bounce it, I'm never going to talk to you. Because there are 35,000 people in the stadium watching you when you do this, and you walk out to the pitcher's mound, and you got to throw it the 60 feet, from the pitcher's mound to home plate. and it was a great honor, and I didn't bounce it. Just a fantastic special moment.
We've got a picture up here in front of us from the Boston Globe. You're wearing brown slip-on shoes, John. You're not necessarily giving yourself the best chance there. I would have thought it'd be amazing for grip.
I was not in great baseball gear, but I pulled it off. I was really nervous. It's really funny the things that make you nervous. Like you're just tossing a ball.
Probably way more nervous than election night, you know,
when you're by leaps and bounds.
It's an amazing highlight, I have to say, John. Murph, it is now over to you to rank this sporting life of CNN's John King.
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, John, you've been a total mensch this afternoon, or a lake, as they'd say out in Dunlochan. But it's business time, so I will move now to my own version of the magic wall, my almost illegible scribbles on the back of a cigarette packet, to crunch the numbers and see if you have secured enough points to oust Hollywood superstar Brendan Gleeson and take top spot in the race to become our top non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2024. There's no denying that your all-time sporting highlight, throwing a ceremonial first pitch at Fenway Park, the home of your beloved Red Sox, against the New York Yankees, is impressive. However, the moccasins are going to lose you some points. That said, your mammoth 14-hour shifts manning the magic wall on election night tells me you've got some toughness about you. You're a steely-eyed competitor. When it comes to toughness and Boston, they don't get any tougher than Ted Williams, who fought in two wars and still found time to be one of the greatest baseball players of all time. And it was precisely that quality that was needed to close out your 150-mile cycle along the rugged coastline of New England, a feat that old Ted himself would surely have been proud. Throw in your beautiful show of solidarity with a childhood friend, and the points are really starting to add up. So much so that I'm now ready to call today's score. There are no hanging chads here, no misplaced ballots. It's 82 points, good enough for joint second place. John King, this has been your sporting life.
You're only behind Brendan Gleeson, John, so you got to be happy with that.
This would be quite controversial in today's day and age, but I respect the count of the judges. even though I wish I would come in first place, I trust the accountability and the accuracy of the system.
John, you've been absolutely amazing. Can't wait to see loads of you over the next few months. A round of applause, please. Thank you so much to John King.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
That was To Each His Own by Talos and the beautiful voice of Owen French, an amazingly talented musician from Cork who sadly passed away last weekend in his mid-30s. Our thoughts go out to Owen's family and friends. What an absolute pleasure it was spending some time with John King today. Not a bad broadcaster, is he, Murph? Great to see him respect the democratic process there by graciously accepting his joint second place. No claims of a rigged system, no legal challenges. No. He was beaten by Brendan Gleeson. And that's that.
And you know, looking back, wouldn't it have been better if Colin McCann had just accepted his result last week rather than trying to weasel a couple of extra points off me? I mean, you know, at the time I just folded, but surely democracy is at the centre of, you know, everything that that we hold dear. I take my hat off to John King. He's a top man.
I got to say, when he was talking us through the magic wall there, it felt like he had transported us into the near future and we were already in the middle of election night. I was maybe we shouldn't have asked him about it because I started getting nervous, sweaty palms. It felt like we were right in the middle of the big time there for a moment. But he's such a great talker that I am being told, Murph, I need to wrap this show up right now. We are out of time. Saturday Sport is on the way. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. Thanks to Johnny Lanagon and RTE. You can hear our full range of podcasts Monday to Friday on secondcaptains.com. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.